Hello and welcome to episode 9 of the RTE Rugby Podcast, available on RTE.ie, iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify and wherever you get your podcasts. Contact us with any feedback on Twitter at RTE Rugby or Facebook /RTE Sport. Shortly we'll hear from two provincial captains, Munster's Peter O'Mahony and Ulster's Rory Best, ahead of this weekend's Heineken Champions Cup quarterfinals. We'll be talking at length to Eric Miller, who lined out for both Leinster and Ulster. We'll also hear from Michelle Ring, manager of UL Bohemian, who have topped the league standings in the women's AIL for the fourth year in a row. And with me here in studio are Wes Liddy, producer of Against the Head, and also Michael Glennon of our online sports desk. And first call as ever, Michael, is what rugby items are proving popular on the RTE website?
Yeah, as you can imagine, we've moved away from the Six Nations news as all the guys come back to provincial duty. The news came out earlier in the week. Joey Carberry has extended his stay at Munster. I mean, at the time when he moved to Leinster, there was some talk about this two-year thing to get him some game time before the World Cup, and he's obviously fitted in brilliantly down there. Some Ulster injury problems ahead of the match on Saturday. Paul O'Connell announcing that he won't stay on for what was a planned second year at Stade. And then I was talking to Jordan Larmer the other day, and he hopes that Leinster can let loose against Ulster.
Nothing concrete on Ronan O'Gara for a coaching role yet, is there?
No, I mean, from what I took up from him was that he would be open to that. I mean, there's moves in France. He said he played it down a bit, that he wasn't ready to sign, but that, you know, it's something he is interested in. He is interested in broadening his coaching experience, as you can see, from what he's done already.
Whereas you haven't, if you don't know things about Munster, I don't know who does. What are you reading into Paul O'Connell stepping away and saying maybe he's not going to have a coaching role next season? A surprise?
No, not to me. I think he has a few other non-rugby things maybe lined up, but there's a story in the Limerick Leader actually last week that Mike Prendergast was potentially going to find his way to Toulon in the off-season, and you know, now there's a bit of talk that maybe Paul could end up there with him too. So, yeah, we'll see what happens. I think Ronan wasn't the only Irish man in the mix for a position in the French backroom team, but I don't think that's come to pass either. We won't say anything for a couple of days yet.
Okay, well, we'll chat to Eric Miller in a minute, but let's hear a couple of those who will be involved in Champions Cup action at the weekend. Michael Corkin spoke to Munster's Peter O'Mahony on Monday and talked specifically about slotting back in from international duty ahead of their quarterfinal on Saturday.
Yeah, we're straight back in. You know, the biggest game of the year for the club. But I think, to be fair to the internationals that are coming back, you know, we've kind of been in this position before, and you just got to have to fit in. You just straight back into it and as if you hadn't left. And just, you know, drive it on as you would it normally any other week. But there's a great excitement around the building. You know, I'm just back in this morning, but it's you know straight away the European Cup weeks, and you know it's a little bit more special when you're talking about knockout rugby.
And we can also hear from Rory Best ahead of the All-Irish quarter-final, Leinster v Ulster at the Aviva on Saturday evening.
Yeah, look, it's been a really strong almost 12 months for us. You know, you look at the tail end of last season and into this season, and yeah, look, I think it's out of our control what other people think and the assumptions people make about what we're doing, but you know, we've been reasonably happy with the way we're going. Obviously, we see a lot of room to get better, and we want to keep getting better, and I think the progress has been steady, and we got to make sure we find out how to get that curve keep going upwards, and obviously from my point of view and from the players' point of view, we want that improvement to be as steep as it can be, and it's going to be a really tough game this weekend. You know, I think there's no doubt over the last couple of years that this is the best team in Europe that we're playing against in Dublin. So look, it's all stacked against us, but I think it's a lot of where you see the character of a team in these sort of games, in these sort of environments.
And just a note about our radio coverage. We start actually with an extended game on Friday evening for full commentary of the Sale v Connacht Challenge Cup quarter-final. Kick off there at 7:45. And we have an additional game on from 12:30 on Saturday for Edinburgh v Munster. Full live commentary on 2FM. That is a 12:45 kickoff. Well, Eric Miller, as I said, is with us in studio, formerly of Leinster and Ulster. And Eric, how much focus does Heineken Cup quarterfinals play for you? You're involved with a few clubs, you've all sorts of things going on, so are you focusing on these matches at the weekend? Do they get your pulse racing at all?
Yeah, I'm excited to see probably to quote Jordan Larmer, the players probably come out of their Six Nations shells and go back into their provinces and probably play more expressive type games. I see that developing in Ulster under Dan McFarland and similarly Leinster can play, adapt and play anyway. I think that they did that very well last year in the final against Racing. So I think they're that well developed. They can change their style and approach even within a game depending what presents itself in front of them. So I'm looking forward to seeing if the players who came off some bad form jump back into the provinces and that feel-good factor and then use that as a springboard to start playing well again. I think it'll people will start speculating on whether that will develop into a bigger conversation, whether Ireland need to adapt and develop a more of a continuity game type approach or have an more adaptable game plan that's ready for the teams come the World Cup. So it'll be interesting to see how players bounce back. But I probably see nothing but positive for most of the guys who are obviously looking forward to jumping into another competition.
And did you feel that the guys were in the Six Nations were very shackled and very, I mean, you sort of alluded to it there, that they had no freedom really?
There's a number of factors involved, but there has to be a percentage of it that, you know, teams have us figured out, we're not really going anywhere type mentality, and the frustration was borne out in a number of players, and that's definitely the style of play or having another few strings to their bow, I think, comes into play there in the subconscious of the players. It has to be part of it. I think there's a lot of other factors involved as well, but that would be one just from my experience of playing the game, that, you know, if you're not going forward and guys aren't running onto balls and our forwards are being targeted and stopped on the gain line, we end up kicking it away. There has to be more things to that. Now, in saying that, it's a huge jump up in terms of the physicality and even the space available, I think, is growing even bigger now between international rugby and Heineken Cup and then beyond and below that, should I say. So I think that's also an interesting topic.
You think the gap between international rugby and Champions Cup is widening?
I think yeah, obviously teams, particularly obviously Six Nations teams, know each other so well. And the analysis done on Ireland, obviously, between being put on that pedestal post All Blacks, I mean, teams figured us out very, very quickly and adapted and came gunning first come the Six Nations, and we just didn't probably adapt quick enough. And you know, there's probably a larger conversation that we can go into. I think what the problem in Ireland, and has been always a problem even when I played, is there has to be some sort of connection between what the provinces are doing, what the international team is doing in terms of a style of play or an underlying default, a go-to sort of plan, because I think the skill sets of the players coming out of schools, and I can probably only speak for Leinster, what they're doing at academy level and the skill sets and all the subtleties you see in the likes of James Ryan with his sidestepping and being always able to make that half yard, and those core skills and offloading and all those things that they probably utilise more within Leinster and obviously to an extent in the other provinces. I'd like to see a bit more of an overlap and a bit more of a... I've been able to jump to another way of doing things if plan A doesn't work. And I just see there's a disconnect there between these young lights coming through. Let's see what some of the stuff they can bring to Joe Schmidt power play type game, which is obviously has worked. And you can't, I mean, this is nothing against Joe Schmidt, but I think as they're rethinking, I'm trying to look from the outside in, as they have to maybe bring that together, because I think when the likes of Wales, France and New Zealand in particular, there is an overlapping between, say, New Zealand, the NPC teams, the way they play and the way the All Blacks play and the way their teams play and their Super 14s. There is a consistent style of play that players just jump in and out of depending which level they're at, whereas we have a very different styles and patterns of play within the provinces, which I think are becoming a bit more similar now. And what Dan is doing up north and Leinster, there's similarities, and obviously what Connacht have done, obviously beginning with Pat Lamb and then with Andy Friend as well, there's that sort of free flow sort of approach with multiple options and decoy lines and run and lines of running. So again, to go back to my first point in terms of the space available at international level, there has to be a sort of marrying of something, taking into account what Joe Smith has done has worked, obviously, a high percentage of the time, and you can't take that away from him. And that bedrock is there. But I also think we need to obviously do other things now, pre-World Cup, to be able to express ourselves and maximise the talents of the group in other ways.
And maybe that was contrasted with the success of the 20s in the Grand Slam, who did seem to play a more free-flowing game when the opportunity arose, and could also defend extremely well also. So I mean, maybe they were given a bit more latitude to think for themselves out on the pitch. Would you say that was
true? I think so. Yes, and I mean, it's very hard to be critical of Joe Smith because I'm such a big admirer of what he's done and what he's brought. And but he's, in some ways, he coached differently at Leinster than he has done with Ireland. Now, he's found the recipe for success, and he said this is the best way Ireland are going to win or be successful, and that's understandable. We can't play like the All Blacks all the time and beat them. We're not going to beat them more than four or five times out of ten playing the same way. So I can understand that he's maximised that pressure game that we've played. But I think teams have found that out now, and we have to adapt with that. And it'll be interesting to see how the guys express themselves, going back to your first point, in the provinces, and then how that gives him food for thought going forward in terms of what two or three styles of play can we bring to a World Cup, where he will have time with the players over the summer to harness a few things. And I'd say there'll be no one better than himself, and the rest of the players will collaborate on that for sure.
Eric, do you think that adding something to the game would involve introducing new personnel at this stage? Is it too late, or with Joe, has he just to go all out and maybe select lads that probably weren't in favour before? And
yeah,
I'm talking about lads who are overseas.
I think it'll be that's very interesting. Obviously, there's been speculation and talk about, by the way, Sean O'Brien came off the pitch and one or two other players. I think there's two arguments. If you give them, if there's a more underlying game plan to sort of where it allows free Sean up, I think there's that argument, or he's had his day and it's time to hang up his boots. I think these are things we'll only see with time. But I think a couple of fresh faces, I think things got a bit stale, not only with the game plan. There's an argument for saying that within the group, are things a bit stale in terms of personnel. I think there's no harm in a few fresh faces.
I suppose before the 2009 Grand Slam, there was a couple of guys dropped off the panel that probably had not done very little wrong. Mm-hmm. And it was introduction of a few new guys that did work.
Yes, obviously, as we'll discuss, you know, I think Ulster will probably be potentially with Addison this weekend. I think he's the type of guy. He's obviously played fullback against the USA for Ireland, but if Ireland are thinking differently, and I'm just again speculating, if Addison was seen as another centre playmaker. Bundyaki does a reasonable job, and again, we have to see how Robbie Henshaw comes back of where they put him. But at centre, he can do a reasonable job as well. But he could be an excellent playmaker that would take pressure off Sexton, potentially, if he was to think that way in terms of an alternate plan going forward. So I think there's manoeuvring room with the likes of guys, as you said, maybe fresh faces, but also guys who've, the likes of Will Addison, who'll maybe get to express some more of the subtle aspects of his game within a new framework. So all these things are kind of suck it and see. Let's wait and see what happens. But there are options there within the group that we have, and maybe some young guys like Scott Penny, one of these bolters, may come through for the World Cup, and you'll see some of those guys maybe step up to before the end of the Champions Cup, and we'll see. We'll go from there.
Is it a bit of a sign of the times in terms of the focus on Ireland, or maybe since the restructuring of the tournament, the European Cup, but you know, we've got three Irish teams in action in the Champions Cup, including a derby match, and yet we kind of spend our time still looking back towards the Six Nations. It would have been almost unthinkable, or the opposite, that would have happened 5-10 years ago. Do you think has the tournament lost its lustre a small bit compared to when you look back to 2009 or 2010, Croke Park semi-finals, all the rest of it?
Yeah, teams know each other so well, and you know, I think there was obviously a buzz out of beating French teams. I think that started, certainly in my experience, under Matt Williams. 2002, we went down to what's now Clermont, where they were called Montferon, and we had a huge win down there. I remember that moment seemed to start the Irish teams winning regularly. So that was obviously, that garnered the attention of people, you know, that newness of beating French teams. Now it's sort of regular, on a regular basis. So I still think it's a fantastic competition. I think we're going to have some cracking matchups. I think the English and French teams come at the back end of the season, so I think the Irish teams again are primed in terms of, you know, if bodies are healthy, you know, they'll be thereabouts. I think Ulster won't fear coming down, and they'll have their own healthy support by all accounts, and they've had success you know, in the Aviva and before, and will be more than a match. So that'll be a cracking game. But I think for me, I always enjoy watching the Champions Cup. Different styles of play. Obviously, coaches with different sort of approaches to the way their teams play. It's always fascinating to see. So I'm looking forward to them. But again, the Six Nations, I get this feeling that teams have each other figured out so much. And there was nearly stalemate stuff at times in some of the games. Outside the Scotland, England, it was a blessing in disguise when it came. I think the tournament needed that. And I know it's a World Cup year, but outside of that, I think the point of teams being so analysed at that level and coaches knowing each other so well, it sort of nullified the Six Nations a little bit in that regard. So in that sense, I can understand your point, but for me, I think it's a premier competition, we look forward to the weekend.
We'll move on from the Champions Cup in a moment, but I suppose Rory Best said Leinster are probably the best team in Europe. Would you give Ulster a sniff against them? They did really well to get out of the pool. A lot of their own supporters, I don't think, expect them to get out of the pool. But what would you think of them coming down to the Aviva? There's going to be a tough
I think one. They play a good style of rugby, and they've had success with that. I think there's a couple of centres injured. I think Addison will be out, and potentially
he was a big player as well.
Yeah, he's a big player for them. I mean, my young Michael Larry's done well in some of the in the league games, and imagine Darren Cave might recover from his knock, and probably be partnering with McCloskey in the centre. So I think they'll certainly give it everything. Their forward pack. I mean, Henderson. I'm not sure if he's still a doubt or if he's touch and go, obviously, and he'll be a big loss as well. So if they don't go in with their full side, you've got a fancy Leinster. But and I think the loss to Edinburgh will probably just make sure that they're primed and ready and not to give up their crown just yet. So, but I think it'll be a cracking game. I think two very progressive minded coaching setups in the way they play. But Leinster will do what they need to do, if that means picking and going in the opposition 22 and 40 plus phases to get over the line, they'll do that. But I think they'll also want to go out and express themselves, as I said, particularly at the outset with the other guys coming back in, they'll want to go out and play. So the way they've been coached, and looking forward to seeing that.
So speaking of Edinburgh, and obviously they're playing Munster, and both Scottish teams in the quarterfinals for the first time ever. Munster going over to Edinburgh, probably quite difficult.
Yeah, I think so. Richard Cocker has done a fantastic job there. There's a couple of internationals that have come through the Edinburgh ranks. Very, very tough team to break down. I think they're very clued into what they're doing. They buy into what they're doing. And I think Munster will have their hands full, but Exeter were through everything at Munster, and Munster still ground out. They still have that ability to grind out victories when they look as if they're dead and buried. So I think it'll be a severe test for them. It's a very tough one to call, but with the historical pedigree, just much like the big schools teams in the schools cup, you know, you play a team that's not so well known who has a very sort of strong squad in any given year. Often the history of and that's so much weight behind Munster's performances in the cup may well just shade it for them.
Whereas, do you see any vulnerability in Munster?
Yeah, definitely. Not so much their own vulnerability, but I suppose a lot of that history that you talk about and the famous wins, like what seems to kind of, you know, what's galvanised them over the years and all the games we remember are kind of backs to the wall efforts, often as an underdog. I suppose Edinburgh, you know, whether it's the familiarity with them, whether it's the lack of success they've had historically, the half 12 kickoff in Murrayfield, it maybe doesn't quite get you bristling the way playing Toulon and Thomond Park did in last year's quarterfinal. So I suppose that sense that you're maybe not quite at the pitch is a slight worry. But in a weird way, not all of them, obviously, but a lot of Munster guys actually are probably coming back from the Six Nations in quite a good headspace. Not necessarily frontline starters for Ireland, but there was a lot of guys who were in the extended Irish squad who've actually done their international chances no harm. If you look at Dave Kilcoyne getting in ahead of Jack McGrath for the first time in years, if you look at John Ryan getting in ahead of Andrew Porter for the last game, the same story with Niall Scannell over Sean Cronin. Tadhg Byrne getting his debut, pretty horrible debut for him in the end, in fairness. But those guys' individual places in the national hierarchy have actually been boosted despite the poor campaign. So between that and just not having as many starters, potentially maybe Munster aren't as affected maybe as Leinster are by Ireland's somewhat indifferent form. But at the same time, we've never really in all the years of the European Cup seen a team come back in after Six Nations and fall off a cliff form wise. We've always said, is it a danger? But ultimately it's never happened, so I guess it'll be the same again for the Irish teams, hopefully.
What about Connacht and Sale? We'll have that on Friday night on 2FM. Sale at home, impressed with Andy Friend's contribution to Connacht. They've got a great chance of qualifying automatically now for next season's Champions Cup.
I think he's definitely been kind of a breath of fresh air, really. I mean, even in his dealings with the media, he's kind of pretty open and interesting to listen to. And obviously, I suppose Jack Carty being the most noticeable, Farrell in the centre as well. But a lot of guys who were, I mean, different degrees of how heralded they were coming into the season. But, you know, much like in Pat Lamb's time, I suppose they seem kind of invigorated, full of confidence, willing to kind of appear to play off the cuff a little bit, even though that's probably not the case. But it looks that way from the outside sometimes anyway.
Eric, you went Leinster, Leicester, Ulster, and then back to Leinster. How did that Ulster move come about?
Yes, it was a mid-cycle in European competition. It was my fourth year in Leicester, I think, at the time. And I'd parted ways with Leicester close to the beginning of that season. I think the quota of Leinster squad had already been filled in terms of the Heineken Cup at that time. And on the way to coming home, obviously to be reintegrated and to get involved and stay in rugby, sort of a couple of months into the season, Ulster opened the door for me, and it was the year after they'd won the Heineken Cup, and Harry Williams was very obliging in allowing me to become part of a squad. We didn't have a particularly good year. I think it was on the back of Ulster. We're at the back end of that particular cycle with players and probably Harry as well. I think it was final year, or maybe went on for a year after that. In terms of the European Cup that season, I think we went out in the group stages, hadn't played Wasps and a couple other big teams at that stage. It was a very enjoyable experience. Shared a house with James Topping and was made feel very welcome up there within the rugby fraternity. And Deanna Quinigan, who was Irish captain back in '99 for the World Cup, was up there and had experience there. And he shared a similar experience than I had. I had a great season. Obviously, it was a home from home, but I was obviously in my head. I was on my way home in my head, getting back to Leinster, and Matt Williams took over for Mike Warrock the year after that, and obviously filtered back into Leinster. But it was a very enjoyable year, and really enjoyed my experience. And not saying I surprisingly felt more welcome than I thought I would, but sort of fitted well. And I think that's probably a given now, the way players are moving. But back then it wasn't as regular. It was beginning to happen. The likes of Jordan Murphy had come over to Leicester and other players, but it was obviously not as prevalent as it is nowadays. But they were a good bunch of lads, and I'm sure Jordy Murphy and the lads up there now would say the same thing. And you know, you always have this perception of the north and the south, and you know, coming from Dublin and going up to Ulster, and I'm sure the lads have been pleasantly surprised, if at all surprised, of how they fitted in. I'm sure it's been a positive experience for them.
Is it says a lot about the Leinster coaching structure in the schools and the academies that they have such a surplus, and it probably will continue on like that with the other provinces benefiting from the setup in Leinster.
For sure. You know, I had the experience of coaching Leinster youths for 3 years back in 2010. I coached Tadhg and a couple other lads, Adam Byrne, in that year as well. And you could see it this with the Leinster really getting to grips with the non-playing rugby schools in the province. That added huge impetus in what has transpired to be a conveyor belt of players in the last number of years. So that's kudos to that that plan. And the youths was particularly, again, coming back to my club experience, They really appreciated being there. I'm not saying all the elitist schools. I think you talk to anybody nowadays that the guys coming from club rugby who didn't play schools rugby in the schools cups but play for under-18s clubs, they really appreciated putting on the jersey when they got the opportunity. So it was a thrilling experience working for the youth. So that attitude and that value for the jersey has kept the so-called bigger school guys who come into the Leinster. It doesn't necessarily happen for those guys as quickly, and they sort of have to work their way. I remember that's happened with Jack Conan, came out of Gerrards. I wouldn't say an elitist school, but certainly a Dublin, you know, private school, and he found his way eventually. And, you know, maybe not directly in competition with guys coming from the youths, but I think the blend of that sort of, I suppose, that honesty and that value of the jersey from those under 18 lads at club level coming into that's has sort of added a sort of honesty and a sort of humility to the whole thing that maybe that got rid of that perception of the D4 Dublin school sort of tag. And I think that's all been a positive thing for the underage all the way through, obviously, to the seniors.
Tell us a bit about your involvement, Eric. You're not coaching at the Joe Schmidt level, but you're a busy man in rugby as well as in life. But what rugby-wise, what are you doing at the moment?
Yeah, I obviously retired 13 years ago, and I've been doing a number of things. Straight after retirement, I'm still doing the same number of things. So I've sort of found my niche with the variety, and I particularly enjoy doing two or three different things, and thankfully I've been able to do that. It obviously involves three teams at the moment, obviously one school and two clubs. So I'm with Seapoint, who I coached before I went to Asia for a couple of years. I coached them for a year back in 2013, and then went back, and this is my third year now since my second stint, hanging in there at the bottom of 2C. And I think you know, we try to make the most of what we have. We're a small club. You could breeze past it, Kilgobba Park, on a jog or on a walk, and you'd walk by the club not knowing it's there. I think their mini rugby section's very heralded. I think it's the third or fourth biggest in Ireland, and I think down the line the club are hoping to connect that more to the senior ranks and be able to elevate things. But we punch above our weight, considering some of the big named Dublin clubs historically have gone down to, unfortunately, gone down to junior rugby in the last number of years. So we're hanging in there. It's the last couple of games in the next few weeks. So we're on a bit of an upward curve, but we still have to get over the line. And also been involved with Eden Derry this year, which has sort of fell on my lap, and I've really enjoyed my stint there as well. And the great bunch of lads, pretty much from the same locality, most of them, even though a good few of them are commuting from Dublin. Their commitment has been excellent, and they're just a great bunch to work with. And thankfully, we got promoted this year, back to where they were last year. They got relegated, so back up to 2A. So I get the thrill out of club coaching and seeing the bunch of lads and the club coming together from a difficult situation at the beginning of the year, and that always gives me pleasure, and that's the buzz I get out of coaching. And there's a new development programme in COS school, which has been a school similar to my experience in Gerrards.
Where you coached.
Back for 5 years, back around 08 to 2012, sort of 450 plus pupils, not maybe in the top 10 or 12 schools, sort of underperformed. Logistically challenged with most of the lads, like Belvedere, living on the north side, half of them playing Gaelic football and commuting to a city centre school with pitches on the south side. So amidst the logistical challenges, there's a director of rugby in place, and is really trying to, the new principal has given a lot of flexibility and latitude to really pump a lot into the new development programme there. So it's good being involved with that and seeing that the genesis of that starting to take shape. But that will be a sort of medium to long term thing. So that's I love the development side of the game as well. And thankfully I'm in a role that allows me to connect with guys and be an influence and be able to coach guys at a younger level as well. So.
And are you ambitious to be coaching, we'll call it, superior level teams, be it higher up in the league or provincial or anything like that? Or because I know you're kind of like, I read a fair bit about your coaching with Eden Derry and, you know, really wanting, it's really amateur rugby old style, and really wanting to add something for them and to make it an enjoyable place for them to come and not a hassle. Whereas you look at the pros, and they're well paid and all that, but I mean, sometimes it seems like it's a job.
Yeah, it's a job. Yeah, I don't see it as a job. I'm very lucky, and you have to love what you do. And I think, you know, it's not it's nothing to do with being afraid of trying to take the next step. It's, I suppose, with my two daughters, my family commitments are primary, and I think that would probably disappear if I was to. So that's not in the plans at the moment. I like the sort of balance of things. I am an ambitious person, but I'm not, I don't think too far ahead in terms of the rugby career. Sort of, I've adopted a child in the last number of years, and that sort of made us take a step back. We were dealing in the now for 2 years with that, so really sort of beginning, obviously just coming at the back end out of that, and taking things as they come with her and how much she needs, and my other daughter as well, obviously, and I suppose taking life as it comes. Placed a lot of demands myself as a player. I never promised myself that I wouldn't do the same thing when I stopped. I've just sort of probably relaxed a bit and been able to just take things year by year. I don't rule out anything for the future, but I sort of enjoy the way things are at the moment, and the commitment an adopted child needs is important, and myself and my wife agree that that's of paramount importance. So the balance is good at the moment. So,
and you adopted the child effectively as a consequence of going to take a coaching job in Sri Lanka, which is a very strange sounding thing to most people probably listen to this. Can you just give us some background on that?
Yeah, no, there's a good friend, Dan Van Zyl, who now runs, he's part of the Leinster underage setup, who now runs his own academy, I think, in Nace, with another South African contact. Obviously, through them, I got wind of a club role in Sri Lanka back in 2014. I said, no harm having an experience of coaching abroad in a different culture, would be very challenging, but also, I imagine, rewarding as well. So that was the plan. And then it's being a 7 or 8, 9 month season, there was time on the hands when we arrived, and we found ourselves in an orphanage, and my wife and eventually myself fell in love with a little child there. And, you know, it was obviously a great experience working with some of the young children. I even brought the players there, which is always a good thing for young players to experience when they don't even know a place down the road from them. This is a privileged school in Kandy, which is the second biggest city, and they didn't even know this place is down the road. For them, coming from a privileged background and seeing something like that, as myself and Jenny did, was also, it was great to see them experience that, but obviously our own experience and meeting Nisha, and sort of things developed from there. And beyond all the red tape, we managed to get her back home a number of years later. And obviously, because of the consequences of her disability and Sri Lanka being a third world country in many respects in relation to her recovery and rehab, we had to decide to come home. So we're sort of bouncing back on the back of that. And that's how we sort of live year to year. So
yeah. I remember listening to Cliff Morgan, who's on a sort of 40 years of sports report, the BBC, then BBC Radio 2 programme. He talked about the Lions going to the township in South Africa and all that, and what an amazing thing it was. Of course, the Lions tour is one of the highlights of your career. What do you think of the Lions concept now, and how the tours are short and it's more or less 3 tests and 5 other games or 6 other games? And is this what it was? How do you view the Lions tours now?
I mean, as far as I can see from the players, it hasn't diluted. I think it's for many players outside of a World Cup, it's the ultimate goal. And I probably speak on a good few players from all 4 provinces, so I know there'd be a player revolt if there was any thoughts to the contrary or dropping the concept. You're talking about a global game concept, which has been mooted, is sort of another conversation, and that's probably a step too far. But I think the Lions has to stay together, and I think as a brand, will have challenges to adapt to an ever more demanding game in terms of the global picture. It seems that's where it's going. So hopefully it'll fit in as part of that. I think it's an imperative part of it. Being able to come together with guys from 3 other countries is just a wonderful experience, and you know, you're kicking lumps out of them most weeks, but it's a unique experience. And it's just, if you're lucky enough to be with a great group of people, as I was for 97, and that's the memories that are cherished. I mean, I know it's so much more professional now, but there's so many things that are experienced off the pitch that I think the players resonate with more than what's just seen in terms of the technical stuff and as you said, the condensed times and the games themselves. I think that's the true value of it. And knocking back to why I coach club rugby, that's the buzz I get out of that is a sort of similar sort of concept as what I experienced on that tour. So albeit from a coaching perspective.
Well, to touch on some of the stories that are in the news and in the broader game, there's the potential law changes. So what about those law changes?
Well, without having looked at them too exhaustively, I was talking to Eddie O'Sullivan yesterday, actually, and he kind of put a pretty good spin on it, but I often find there's kind of an unintended consequences whenever rules are tampered with, and like the 50-22 rule, as it's kind of known, with the kicking, where you would reclaim, basically, if you bounce a ball into touch, where you would kick, you kick from inside your own half and you land in the opposition 22 and it bounces on the way to touch, you would get the line out rather than, you know, the opposition getting it. Like, it seems to be kind of being suggested that all these rules are framed around, in some degree or other, around a desire to cut down head-on collisions. But to me, the idea that the advantage gained from allowing an out half or a four centre or whatever it might be to sit in the pocket and kick is going to mean that every defence is blitzing, and meaning there's more head-on collisions. And equally, the breakdown rules where, like, one, I think the idea that you can say there'd be no jackling is just ridiculous. The horse is bolted, it's become such an important skill. You know, I don't see how they could wring that out of the game overnight. It's almost like you'll have trained guys that are becoming professional for 20 years where that's their primary skill, and all of a sudden it doesn't count. So they're saying you'd enter the ruck in the more traditional manner and have to drive over the ball. But I mean, to me, the consequence of that is just that no one contests a ruck, aside from the safety side. Instead of committing bodies to a breakdown, you're effectively fanning bodies out, and that means more collisions, less space again. So they might actually end up achieving the opposite of what they hope to achieve. And more to the point, why don't they just call it rugby league at this stage if they're bringing in both those rules, which, you know, I wouldn't be a fan of what I heard so far. But
yeah, there's a knock-on effect, obviously, because I think one of the rules, I think rule 18 or whatever, in terms of the line out, you don't have to have the same amount of players in the line out as the throwing team. So do you drop a forward in the backfield to negate that? To negate that, the space for the kicker. From a positive aspect, will it challenge teams to, instead of having a one-dimensional exit strategy of just kicking it, will they see how many players drop back and play more phases closer to the line and see and suck it and see what happens in terms of the opposition knowing that you're trying to achieve that as well. So I think there'll be a couple of things that will come into the mix outside of one rule change. Other rule changes will be exploited to negate or add to that. And I think tactically as well, it'll be challenging. But, you know, one may cancel out the other, as Wes said, but it'll be interesting to see. In terms of the tackle and jackal, you already have the best. You see, the best poachers in the world are very adept. And you mentioned just the fanning out of when to go in and pull out last minute when they know they're going to lose that battle off the ruck. And I think it's a timing issue. I think more for the referees in terms of when a guy gets bumped. Some referees will blow for the pinch or the poach immediately in favour of the defender if he's there in that jackal position. And other referees wait 5 or 6 seconds till the guy's clobbered. And then eventually either go one way or the other. And I mean, I think there was a statistic there, one of the teams, or that the open sides are the ones who are getting, in terms of position, are the ones taking most of the flack in terms of injuries. But so I think there's a huge decision-making component for the referees and the players. You find that the best guys over the ball are the guys, if they're going to lose that battle to the ruck, they tend to pull out. Pocock's particularly adept at doing that, or whether he goes in for the pinch, then it's down to referee's interpretation, which I think is too broad, because it's all to do with their interpretation of the ref, where he has to see it for longer, or whether a referee's an interpretation, if the guy wins the shoulder battle, the defender before the attacker, then he blows immediately. So I think there's too much left to chance there, and they do have to come to very much more clarity in terms of that decision-making process, particularly for referees, but then obviously players and everything else, and rules, guys will adapt to whatever else is put in place. And that could either, as you said, as Wes said, eliminate some of the things they're aspiring to achieve.
Is jackling a teachable skill? Do you ever practice that?
Yeah, for sure. you know, years ago, I remember there's a surfing of the body. Now you've got to come in through the hindmost foot. So it's changed over time. But there is a skill to it.
Because when you see like Tyburn, it just looks like he has a natural instinct for that. Whether that's to do with in his head, he just knows the timing. Mm. But maybe his body shape just looks.
Yeah, no, you're the physical capacity, and then your decision making ability, and the ability to get on the ball, as opposed to hands on the deck and all the smaller things that can go against you. It's a real skill and takes a lot of practice. And I know a lot of open sides over the years who are.
There are drills designed for that skill. Okay.
Yeah, for sure. But I think the premise, as you say, with the collisions in the game, there's too much of a broad interpretation of when the referee's going to blow for the poach, and I see it at club level all the time. Some guys will, referees will immediately recognise that the defender has won the battle, meaning that the attacker has been isolated, in the tackle, and he'll give an immediate decision. And there's other times where. You see, like Sean O'Brien, you know, all those number sevens getting clobbered before the referee finally makes a decision one way or another. So I think that has to be tightened up if they really are want to protect players in terms of that timeline of decision to minimise those three or four impacts before the penalty or before a penalty against the poacher. So I think I can understand what they're trying to do with that. But again, I think the referees have to roll in and become a lot more precise in their decision making.
Is there any law you would like to see changed? It's a hard game. No. I view it as a very hard.
You know, it's a one that always strikes me is if so. There's a scrum anywhere on the pitch, and the one scrum starts to retreat, and there's obviously if there's a collapse, it's different because there's a safety element involved. But it's now once a team gets a push, it's a penalty. Almost within a yard of the push. As you'd well know, starting your career in Leicester, there's no law that you can't push a scrum 50 yards, technically. Mm. You know, how many tries did Dean Richards score, push it over from the base? Mm. You're not allowed dominate a scrum. Well, you dominate a scrum by way of winning penalties rather than by way of marching a team backwards in a scrum. When's the last time anyone's seen a scrum travel more than a yard backwards without a penalty being given? But really, there's no law against being pushed backwards. As long as their bind is still there, why not just let them at it for a little bit longer?
What do you do to relax, Eric? So obsessed. I know that you're an obsessive coach. You come across like that. But do you ever switch off from rugby and say, this is what I'm doing, that I have rugby and it's not in my brain at the moment?
I love my golf. Don't get to play as much as I used to, but I try to. But I switch off. I love watching it. I love keeping up to speed with how guys are doing, and big fan of Rory and Shane, obviously, and I did for a couple of years within the GUI just up to about a year after he became pro, and I think his natural ability, he wanted to speak more than anything else. Now I think he must be keeping in shape now, I think, because I think anyone who's in the top 50 or so players has to be doing something to be that consistent. But it's a huge aspect of all sports, but particularly golf. You see the top 20 lads they're all physically well developed and are managing themselves accordingly. So yeah, so that would be my switch off. It's again difficult to get out, as most people identify for 4 or 5 hours a day. So it might be 9 holes here and there, or maybe just to the range, and then just time with the family. And that's the switch off. And most weekends, because of the nature of my work, I'm working. So I find it very difficult. Suddenly there's a weekend off. You've suddenly got to flip into a family mode, and that's always the most challenging. So I do appreciate some weekday times.
I know when we spoke a few months ago, when you started with Eden Derry, you were talking about hopefully winning and getting promotion, but doing it in the right way. How did that fit in? If you're going down there, it's usually a club who wants to get up straight away and they actually wouldn't care how they won. But you were kind of adamant that you would do this in the right way, and if you won promotion, you won promotion, but you were going to do it. How did that fit in, that holistic approach fit in with the guys you would have met in Eden Derry, who are a provincial town and all traditional town? How did that fit?
No, I think, I think meeting them all at the beginning is important. I was heading over for my daughter's operation in mid-May, so I was determined when I knew I got the job beginning of May to meet all the lads before I went off, instead of just kind of chasing my tail coming back in sort of mid-July. So that's good to sort of develop a rapport with guys straight away, get an idea of how much they're involved. Just cross over to my other club roles as well. Some guys are playing, they're 31, they have 3 kids. there's other guys who are 20 who are going away for a summer and may go to college when they come back. So you're dealing with that spectrum of individuals. So you got to deal, you got to get to know, as you say, the background of guys in this, without sort of delving in too deeply of guys and meeting them where they're at and making sure you're very conscious of trying to pull the best out of all of them, but then managing them accordingly based on how much they're willing to give and giving everybody an opportunity, I think is very important. And you know, the cloak of players coming in tends to develop when they all know they get an equal chance as well, which, you know, which is important to have. So anyone who turns up the training, that was the message from myself and my assistant coach, is we'll get an opportunity at sooner or later, because there's certain guys not on availability and all these things that happen from time to time. You're going to get a chance if you hang around long enough, and thankfully that sort of kicked on that sort of positive approach or mindset towards giving guys a crack, because there's always a diamonds in the rough, the raw ability that's been untapped maybe when they were younger that come through, and you get to work with those guys and then suddenly they're fearless lads who become part and parcel of the team. So again, much like we're talking about the World Cup, you get the blend of the freshness coming through and the young lads keeping the experienced guys on their toes, as well as trying to keep experienced guys to stay on another year and add much value, if not as much physically, certainly in terms of their experience and their mentality and bringing through younger lads. So it's been able to tap into those things.
Okay, well, Eric, thanks a million for coming in. It's been great having you. And
thank you.
We'll be keeping an eye on Sea Point and CUS and Aidan Derry. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Okay, so we're joined by Michelle Ring, who's team manager of UL Bohemian, who have for the fourth season in a row topped the regular season standings in the Women's All-Ireland League. Thanks for joining us, Michelle. Top again, you must be absolutely thrilled.
We're absolutely delighted, especially to turn the corner around Christmas when it wasn't looking likely, but no, we got there in the end.
And that's obviously going to give you a home semi-final. Your home semi-final is going to be against Black Rock. And you had a 5-5 draw with them not that long ago. So obviously you won't be taking it lightly in any case. Now, that 5-5 draw, the 3rd of March, that's the middle of Six Nations time. I suppose both you and they were missing a few players for that, were you?
We were, but what happened with that game was it was the time of the Storm Freya. And the ref actually called the game early, so for player welfare, there was some girls suffering from symptoms of hypothermia, so the game was called at 60 minutes and it was 5-5 apiece. So it was a tough game, but we took the 5-5 and we were happy enough with that.
So what would have happened actually if the score had been 7-5, for example?
Well, if it was 7-5, whoever had converted that first try, you know, they would have won the game.
Oh, if it gets to 60 minutes, you have to get to 60 minutes, is it, to call it?
Well, no, it was the ref's decision at the end of the day, and then it was a decision then by the two branches to leave the score as it was. Now, I'm sure an appeal could have been put in, but we didn't. We were happy enough with the result.
And overall, the season, in terms of the standard in the Women's All-Ireland League, it's just the one top division. What's the standard like? I mean, you played for quite a while and now you're managing the team. How do you see standards across the league?
The standard is quite high, but some games can fall below that during international duty, and especially that we had the Interpro so early in the year this year. There were quite a few injuries at the start of season, whereas the year before that, we would have started off the season with league building into the Interpro, so you would have had a really strong squad starting off the year rather than starting off depleted with international call-ups and injuries, you know. It comes down to some of the teams just being that bit stronger and some teams then falling below that.
Yeah, well, St Mary's, I suppose, were kind of sacrificial lambs. I mean, their points difference was very poor. An average defeat of 40 points a game. I mean, you need, I suppose, to have more stronger teams, more teams for your own benefit. You need more teams at your kind of level.
Absolutely. We were due to play them away and at home. We played them away and then we actually got a walkover for the home game against them. So it's a pity to have walkover the AIL, because you need the games week in, week out to be building as a squad and building individually as players as well.
And what about young players coming through? Do you see an uptick in young players coming through to your team?
Well, this year was probably the first year where we had a lot of transfers over from junior level clubs girls coming up from under 18 because they were involved with the Munster setup during the summer. Some of those girls then were going to UL, so they just decided to transfer over to us to push themselves. And because they came from a Munster under 18 setup, they were used to a high level of training. So that's when they moved over then in September.
And what's, you've got the cup final to come, and then you've got the league semi-final and final. And then what happens after that? Does the team get together, or is there months on end over the summer where there's no team training and people just go off and do their own thing? I mean, we're just not that familiar in Women's All-Ireland League as to the continuity.
Okay, so in Munster, we also have an AIL Munster Cup to play. We've got a semi-final and, all going well, then a final to go as well. So we were actually due to have 6 games in a row until the end of April. So there's a lot of rugby up until then. This year is different. The IRFU have organised the AIL 7, so that's going to be 3 tournaments over an extended period of weeks, 4 or 5 weeks. So it looks like our season is going to continue until the end of May, until they're done. Then with talks of the Interpros being played again in September, you've got a certain amount of girls that will be training interprovincially, and also then pre-season would normally kick in around July. So there wouldn't be that much of a gap. You would want an end of season with a few weeks break, but then you'd want to be coming in for a pre-season around July to start kicking the ground running in September.
And do you see provincial coaches or even national coaches coming to many of the AIL games?
I've seen Adam Greatgrass some of the interprovincial games in September, and some of our away games I saw him at some of those. So yeah, I've definitely seen him, not week in, week out now, but I'm sure that's very hard. And then part of the IRFU plan this year for the AIL coaches was they had to partake in 2 to 3 Ireland camps. So they were involved that way, which was new. It hadn't happened in years before.
OK, well, look, we wish you the best of luck, and to Blackrock as well in the Cup Final, and for yourselves as well in the All-Ireland League semi-finals and final. Thanks very much for joining us, Michelle. Okay.
Thanks so much.
And that's it from another episode of the RTE Rugby Podcast. Thanks to Michelle Ring of UL Bohemian. Thanks a million to Eric Miller for dropping into us in studio. Thanks to Wes and to Michael for their contributions. And don't forget that we have 2 live commentaries on European quarterfinals, both on 2FM, an extended game on Friday night, Sale against Connacht, kickoff 7:45, and a game on rugby special on 2FM on Saturday lunchtime, a 12:30 start of the programme, 12:45 kickoff for Edinburgh against Munster in the Champions Cup. For now, bye-bye.